I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Today, an appreciation of one of music's most iconic and unique figures, Joni Mitchell. A childhood bout with polio rendered her left hand incapable of playing many guitar chords in standard tunings, so she made up her own style of playing that resulted in an unprecedented harmonic language that she coupled with astounding poetry. Her influence is felt today in the worlds of folk, rock, and jazz. David Yaffe has written a comprehensive account of this intriguing talent. He joins me to talk about Reckless Daughter, a portrait of Joni Mitchell. Plus, we'll get an update from the federal courthouse in Baltimore from WYPR's Mary Rose Madden, who's covering the trial of the two Baltimore police officers who are facing corruption charges. Midday starts right after the news. And good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Today, we're going to have a conversation about one of the most iconic figures in all of popular music, the singer-songwriter Joni Mitchell. We're going to talk to a music critic who's written a new biography of this legendary composer and performer. But first, closing arguments are taking place at this hour at the federal courthouse on Lombard Street in downtown Baltimore in the federal racketeering trial of two Baltimore police officers who were members of the now-defunct Gun Trace Task Force. Daniel Herschel and Marcus Taylor are the only two of the eight officers who were indicted to stand trial. The others have all pleaded guilty. WYPR's Mary Rose Madden has been in the courtroom for much of the proceedings. She has she's about to step out of the trial for a minute and give us an update. We are waiting to hear from Mary Rose. Closing arguments were scheduled to begin today at 11 o'clock. Just a little while ago, I heard from Mary Rose that they had not started as of about 11:45 or so. They are evidently underway now. Whether or not the arguments have started is a little unclear, but the judge is at least giving instructions to the attorneys and to the jury. The revelations that have come out of this trial are really quite astonishing. There were eight members of this very elite task force charged with taking guns off of the streets and dealing with the most hardened criminals who are in circulation in the city of Baltimore. Getting an assignment on the Gun Trace Task Force was a peachy job. It was considered a big achievement for all of the officers who were assigned to that unit. And of course, the revelations that came out before the trial began, once the indictments were delivered, and since the trial has been underway for these past couple of weeks, have really been astonishing. The kind of nefarious and completely illegal activity that many of the officers in the elite task force have now admitted to doing. It involves stealing money, stealing drugs, selling the drugs. There was even a car accident involving an 87-year-old man who died two of the officers drove away from. There have been a number of people who have hoped that at the outcome of this trial, however the verdict comes out, will result in some major changes in the police department. It's very difficult to tell whether or not that will happen. It's difficult to know how long it will take the jury to come to a conclusion on this, to come to a verdict. It is likely that they will get the case from the judge sometime this afternoon, although that's not a guarantee scenario, because both sides, the prosecution and the defense, will be given, of course, the opportunity to make their closing arguments, and it's hard to know how long those closing arguments will take. They are underway a little later than they had hoped to be when they started the day. Court usually starts at 10 o'clock. It was scheduled for 11 o'clock today, perhaps an accommodation for the weather. There are some jurors who come from as long as 2 hours away, we're told. But it's difficult to know, again, when the jury will get this, get the information, and hear the final closing arguments and begin their deliberations. We could have a verdict as soon as tomorrow, or it could be sometime even next week. It's hard to know. So we had hoped to talk to Mary Rose Madden that we're not going to be able to do that. Evidently, Mary Rose is hung up and still in court and not able to join us. But we will have complete coverage this afternoon during All Things Considered. And as the verdict is delivered, of course, we will be among many news organizations letting you know about that, because obviously this is a trial that cuts to the very core of people's trust and confidence in law enforcement. But now we're going to move on to a terrific and wonderful singer.
Rose and flows of angel hair, and ice cream castles in the air, and feather canyons everywhere. Looked at clouds that way, but now they only block the sun. They rain and they snow on everyone. So many things I would have done, but clouds got in my way. I've looked at clouds from both sides now.
Joni Mitchell, from a recording she made in 2000 with the London Symphony Orchestra. It's one of her classics, Both Sides Now. She was 57 years old when she sang it in this recording. She was only 21 years old when she wrote that beautiful song. It was made famous by Judy Collins in the 1960s, and it is just one of many songs by Joni Mitchell that has been recorded by a who's who of folk and pop icons. As a composer, Joni Mitchell's harmonic language and literary sophistication are unparalleled. As a performer, she has riveted audiences for decades, from her days as a willowy guitar-slinging soprano to her long career as an exacting and imaginative bandleader whose opus spans from popular idioms to modern jazz. David Yaffe joins me. He's a professor of humanities at Syracuse University and an award-winning music critic. He's the author of an acclaimed biography of Bob Dylan. And for his most recent book, he's turned his attention to Joni Mitchell, tracing her life from her beginnings in rural Canada to her position in the upper echelons of creative artists. The book is called Reckless Daughter, A Portrait of Joni Mitchell. David Yaffe, welcome to Midday.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for this book, which I thoroughly enjoyed. Thank you for that. I think it's fair to say that you're a fan of Joni Mitchell, and and I am too. In my other life, I was a lounge lizard when I was in college in the 1970s. I put myself through college playing clubs and bars, and I had I'm proud to say, a healthy dollop of Joni Mitchell compositions in my playlist. Let's talk a little bit about Both Sides Now, which is such an incredible piece. I think it's an absolutely perfect song. Judy Collins was on our show a few months back, and she told us the story of how she first heard of it, and you recount that story in the book. It was quite a tale, the way she found out about it first. It was in the middle of the night, wasn't it?
Yes. Joni was with Al Cooper. Al Cooper, who played the organ part on Like a Rolling Stone, and who later started a band called Blood, Sweat, and Tears. And Joni was living on West 16th Street in Manhattan, and she was having him over, and she was playing him her songs. And when she played Both Sides Now, which had been recently written, it was 3 a.m, and he picked up the phone and he called Judy Collins and he said, you've got to hear this. And he put the phone on Joni, and Joni didn't say hello. She didn't apologize for waking her up. She just sang the song. And then she didn't say goodbye either. And Al Cooper gets the phone and he says, what do you think? And she says, I'm recording it tomorrow. And she did. She did. I mean, she brought Josh Rifkin over. He transcribed the chords. The chords were pretty simple. Jack Holtzman came up with that that keyboard part right on the spot. that clavichord part, which is such a distinctive part of that record, Judy's version of it. And then it took months to get the mix right.
But she knew, but it didn't take long for Judy Collins to recognize that was a terrific song.
It was incredible. In 1967, she discovered Joni. She discovered Leonard Cohen. And then she was responsible for their meeting because she invited them both to the Newport Folk Festival. That's where they met.
And, you know, the intersection of Joni Mitchell and so many of these iconic figures, Dylan, Joan Baez, mm-hmm. Judy Collins, the guys who were in Crosby, Stills, and Nash, virtually all of mm-hmm. them, Neil Young, her fellow Canadian, mm-hmm. Al Cooper, as you mentioned. It's really mm-hmm. the history of Joni Mitchell is also, this book ends up being an incredible history of pop music through one of its most fecund and famous periods.
Thank you.
The song was ridiculed originally by her husband, Chuck Mitchell, mm-hmm. Who just assumed, I guess, that as a 21-year-old, you're just not worldly enough to know enough about life to comment about it in such sweeping terms, I guess.
You know, when he talked to me, he was used to Joni saying for all these years how condescending he was and all of that. And I know it was all true. But then he told me all the things that were remarkable about her. But he had a BA in English from Principia College. And Joni was an art school dropout who hadn't read much. It's a remarkable thing that she became such a great writer without having read much. And she said, in fact, when she met Leonard Cohen, she said, "Leonard, I've got to read. I did all of my book reports based on classic comic books." and he said, "Well, for somebody who hasn't read, you're writing remarkably well," which is something about Joni that I think is unlike any other writer that I know of her stature. Usually, you know, writers read a lot to write that well, and with Joni, it wasn't necessarily the case.
Yeah,
although, but Chuck, because Chuck had this degree, and he had the pride of the well-educated, as she put it, he was very condescending, and he was also a bit older than her. You know, he was like 8 years older than her. So, this was near the end of their marriage. She came up with that song, you know, April of 67, shortly before she left him. And she played it for him, and he just said, "What would you know about looking at life from both sides?" But of course, by that point, she did know a lot, more than most people her age, because she had survived polio when she was 10, which he knew about. And then she gave up her daughter, which he absolutely knew about because he was part of that decision. And so
they'd had a child, but just decided that the time wasn't right for them to raise this baby.
Well, he wasn't the father, and so part of it was his not being inclined to raise another man's child. But yes, they were penniless. It's not like, you know, it's not. Joni would get annoyed when people would say, "Oh, you gave up your daughter for your career." It's a little more complicated than that. There was no career. There was no career.
Because the two of them were working as a duet, you know, on the folk scene, and they just weren't making a whole lot of money.
But she met Chuck after she gave birth. She met Chuck a month after she gave birth. And at that point, she hadn't even written Urge for Going. Urge for Going is her first major song, or her second song. She'd written one song. Do you know what I mean? She hadn't done anything.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a song that she never recorded, by the way. It's called Day After Day. And it's a great song, but for whatever reason, she didn't record it. So there was nothing. The folk thing was a fad. It wasn't going to last very long. And she thought that she would go into a career in fashion. That was the fallback. She did not think she would become Bob Dylan. She did not think that until she was so miserable and so inspired that in 1966, by the end of 1966, she had written an oeuvre that would surpass those of any of her contemporaries by the end of that first year. She had done something that even Dylan hadn't done. She just didn't I mean, she has a healthy ego. At a certain point, she knew the songs were really good and that she was singing them really magnificently and that her playing was unlike other people's playing.
And we'll talk about that when we come back. David Yaffe, his new book is called Reckless Daughter, A Portrait of Joni Mitchell. We'll have more with David Yaffe and more music of Joni Mitchell, and we'll take your questions and comments if you are a Joni Mitchell fan. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @middaywypr. This is an early tune by Joni Mitchell from just a couple of years after what we're talking about now. This is from 1968, a beautiful song called Marcy. Stay with us.
Marcy in the coat of flowers stops inside a candy store. Reds are sweet and greens are sour. Still no letter at her door. So she'll wash her flower curtains, hang them in the wind to dry.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, we'll take a stroll through the Motor Trend International Auto Show, which opens tomorrow at the Baltimore Convention Center. Rory Cahill knows a lot about cars. His expertise has attracted the attention of General Motors and others. He'll introduce us to a couple of the coolest cars at the show. And oh, by the way, Rory is 13 years old. And believe me, he really knows his stuff. We're also going to talk about industry trends with award-winning car critic Tom Volk. He's the creator of the Driven video series. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews Eugene O'Neill's Long Day's Journey into Night at the Everyman Theater. If you're just joining us today, my guest is David Yaffe, a biographer whose latest book is called Reckless Daughter, A Portrait of Joni Mitchell.
Just before our love got lost, you said, I am as constant as a northern star. And I said, constantly in the darkness, where's that at? If you want me, I'll be in the bar. On the back of a cartoon coaster, in the blue TV screen light, I drew a map of Canada.
A Case of You. David Yaffe joins me from the studios of Public Radio WAER in Syracuse. What's your favorite Joni Mitchell song? You're welcome to be part of our conversation at 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @middaywypr. So, David, this tune, you have some great stories in here about her relationship, Joni Mitchell's relationship with Leonard Cohen. You say that she called Cohen and Dylan the best pace runners she's got. That's really fascinating. For anybody who's ever run a marathon, they know what a pace runner is. But do you agree with her assessment?
I would add a few other people to the list that I think of as peers to Joni Mitchell, but our tastes are not the same. And I think that as she got older, it became increasingly difficult for her to like things, including even Cohen and Dylan.
She said, you quote her as saying that she's Cohen-influenced. She said, I wrote Marcy and thought that it wouldn't have happened if it hadn't been for Suzanne, which is another wonderful song by Leonard Cohen. And she says it's another character sketch. Marcy, the tune we listened to as we were coming out of that first segment. And Leonard Cohen was actually kind of mad at her about one of the lines in A Case of You, the very beginning. Tell us that story.
Oh, I think he was being ironic because she was quoting him. He said to her, I am as constant as the Northern Star. He was quoting Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. Brutus says that to Caesar, and it's not long from there to E tu Brute. But I don't know if Joni realized that he was quoting Shakespeare when he said it. And he said that he didn't say it with Shakespeare's irony. So really, it's like Shakespeare wrote that line, actually.
And Joni appropriated it. Of course, she says later. Joni, she says later in the book, you either steal from life or you steal from books. I mean, that's what poets do. Yeah.
I mean, it's also that there was that verse in the song, "I Met a Woman, She Had a Mouth Like Yours, She Knew Your Devils and Your Deeds," and that's about Leonard's mother. And that's about the same trip that also inspired another song, "Rainy Night House," talking about his mother again in that song. You know, when she did talk about the influence of Dylan and Cohen, it was about lyrics and it wasn't about music.
Yeah,
you know, she didn't think that her music sounded anything like theirs. It was about lyrics only.
Yeah, and I would agree with that.
Yeah, and that is part of what makes the Joni Mitchell phenomenon so unique, because her lyrics don't even necessarily sound like theirs, although she has said that certain songs were written when she was thinking of, say, Suzanne, or when she was, you know, when she saw "Don't Look Back" in the theaters in 1967, it apparently inspired her to write "Cactus Tree." She said that at one point. I brought that up with her later, and she didn't remember saying that. But, you know, that song does have these kind of this barrage of lyrics, where you could see the Dylan influence a little bit. And you could see ways that Joni influenced both Dylan and Cohen as well. Dylan has said that "Tangled Up in Blue" was written while he was listening to Joni's "Blue." It was unclear if he meant the song or the album. He might have meant the album. And in fact, when "Blood on the Tracks" was originally recorded, his brother heard it and thought, "Oh no, this sounds too much like a Joni Mitchell album." So he re-recorded some of the tracks.
Mm. Here's a little bit of the title cut from that track, "Blue." David, this is a piece that she recorded, an album she recorded in June of 1971 at the relatively new A&M Studios, Herb Alpert's relatively new record label. And you set the scene for us, and it's an amazing scene. While she's recording this album, which became her best-selling album, Carole King is in another studio recording "Tapestry," and the Carpenters are in another studio recording one of their albums. I mean, all three things, you know, just blew up incredibly. And as you mentioned, Dylan had this, what he described, I guess, as a kind of like a week-long binge of listening to either the album or at least the title cut that led to "Tangled Up in Blue." It's amazing the reach that this record had. And do you think it's how is it distinguished from her other records?
Well, of course, I'm inclined to see it as a part of a continuum, and I'm inclined to see "For the Roses" as just like the next step. But I realize that this album has a place in our culture beyond all of the others, and I think that what disturbed some of her contemporaries was the thing that made it last. You know, Kris Kristofferson heard it and he said, save something for yourself. You know, Johnny Cash heard it and he said, you've got the weight of the world on you. So some of these men were freaked out. And the album was not initially a hit, and the reviews were not initially great, not uniformly great. It took a little while to sort of seep into the culture, and it was really, I went to college in the 90s, and when I was in college, when people had CDs and not downloads or playlists, right, if there a certain kind of girl would have "Blue" in her dorm room, and it would be a girl that would also be listening to Sarah McLachlan and Natalie Merchant, maybe Liz Phair, you know.
I mean, Joni Mitchell yeah. said, and you quote her in the book, saying that depression can be the sand mm-hmm. that makes the pearl. Mm-hmm. Most of my best work came out of it. I don't think that's particularly unusual for artists. Mm-hmm. But is that something, is depression something that Joni Mitchell dealt with for long periods of time?
I think depression was a mild word to describe what she went through during the period of Blue. I mean, this wasn't something that you could just take Lexapro for or something, if it existed, which it didn't then, obviously. But, you know, she said that she would look at people and cry. She said that, you know, she would just be in a public place and she would see people and she could read into their souls, and that she was taking in everything from everybody. And it was very hard for, and that's why when she recorded the album, the sessions were locked down and only her closest friends were allowed in, and the musicians who played on it. She was barely functioning, barely. And of course that is connected to the emotional rawness on the record and the thing that speaks to people. And this may seem an obvious thing to say, but it's one thing to enjoy it as a listener. It's another thing to have to make it.
Yeah.
And to have to go through what she went through to make it. She can't enjoy it the way we can.
I think that's true. I mean, you talk about you went to college in the 90s. I entered college in 1973, and this record got me through college. I mean, this, and me and a whole lot of my friends, and I was a musician, but so I appreciated it for its musical sophistication, but the poetry is stunning. There's another album or another song. It's a very famous song about skating on a river. Covered, you report more than 500 times by various people, and you also comment about the combination of unsparing autobiography and sparse songs that ejected symmetry. The structure of her tunes, in addition to the harmonic language and the sophistication of the poems, are really unique. This is where she definitely gets away from Dylan-esque songs or even Cohen-esque songs. I mean, the way she put them together is really kind of sui generis.
I mean, that whole song is extraordinary. One moment in that song that I find particularly inspiring, I'm so hard to handle, I'm selfish and I'm sad. That is such a bracingly honest line. You know, most people that make pop songs, they want you to like them, and they wouldn't say something like that. That's such an honest thing to say, you know? And it's so inspiring. And I think, again, she had to get to that dark place. And one of the big takeaways from spending time with her, writing the book, really taking in the totality of her, is that whatever you achieve in greatness, whatever you achieve in success, money, accolades, it's really not enough. Success is certainly preferable to failure, but it's not enough. And having lived it is a weight that you carry with you, I think.
And when it comes to that, you know, brutal honesty of hers, your relationship began a little. Your relationship with Ms. Mitchell began a little rocky. I mean, she. You write about this at the very beginning of the book. She took issue with something that you had written about her, I guess, in the New York Times.
Yes.
So is this book? Would you consider it an authorized biography? I mean, you did spend a fair amount of time with her.
I spent time with her, but no, I had access to her. It's an unauthorized biography with access.
How much access did you have? How much time did you spend talking to her?
Oh, my God. Well, the conversations went on for such a long time. I mean, these were not normal conversations. I mean, these were often, some of the conversations lasted for more than 12 hours. So I first met her for that Times piece, and that was in January of 2007. And we talked quite a bit. I mean, we stayed up all night talking. And then we talked some more. The piece came out. She hated the piece. I did some damage control. And we hung out in Calgary to watch the premiere of this ballet called The Fiddle and the Drum, based on her music and also based on her ideas. And we just kept talking. And then we had a lot of phone conversations. And then she stopped talking to me the following year. And so then I just talked around her. I just talked to everybody else. I talked to everybody I could get a hold of. Almost every studio musician who was alive, I talked to those musicians, in addition to so many other people, and many of them quite extensively. And so one night, and it was 2014, and I was prepared to complete the book without talking to her anymore, because I had talked to so many other people and I had written a lot. And I was out with this mutual friend. He's a sculptor named Nathan Joseph. He rented a loft to her in Soho between 1978 and 1987 on Varick Street. And so we had this really nice night out. We didn't even talk about Joni very much. It was a social evening. We went to his loft. We hung out. You know, I took him out for dinner. And a couple of days later, I get this email from him, and it says, "Joni wants you to call her." Just like that. I did not ask him to grease the wheels with Joni. We just hung out and had a cool time. And that's how we resumed. And then we talked quite a bit, and then I went to Los Angeles in January of 2015, and we had another crazy 12 hours. And a couple of nights before that, I hung out with Leonard Cohen and had this incredible conversation with him for about 5 hours. And
Have you heard from her since the book's been published?
No.
And you don't expect to?
No. I mean, I haven't been in touch with her since the aneurysm. The aneurysm happened.
Right. She's been incapacitated.
I talked to her on the phone after our encounter, and I recorded all these conversations.
Mm-hmm.
And we had many, many, you know. And the last time we talked on the phone was, you know, February of 2015. And then she had the aneurysm March 31st. Or she was discovered in her home.
Right.
3 days after having an aneurysm. She was discovered March 31st. So I was the last person to interview her. And she has not granted a single interview since. Not one.
Right.
So everything that we know about her is anecdotal from, you know, what people report. And, you know, and I find out she's doing this, she's doing that. I saw pictures from her birthday in November, that kind of thing. I mean,
Let me try to get to one caller before we take a break. Elliot in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with David Yaffe.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to tell you. Oh, I grew up in the 60s, early 70s. I was a student at City College, Baltimore City College, back in the day, vice class. Anyway, to make a long story short, I was called the Black Hippie at that time because I listened to Joni Mitchell songs. And she used to make my day. That's all I want to say. She's awesome.
Yeah. Well, you got a lot of folks who can relate to that, but it is interesting. I mean, the Black hippies of the day and the white hippies. There's a whole lot of hippies into Joni Mitchell songs, that's for sure. We're gonna take a little bit of break. Thanks for that call, Elliot. David Yaffe is a humanities professor at Syracuse University. He's our guest today. He's a music critic for the New York Times and many others, and a biographer whose latest book is called "Reckless Daughter: A Portrait of Joni Mitchell. We'll continue our conversation after a break. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWIPR. Here's a little tune, a little bit from the only song that became a number one hit for Joni Mitchell. It's Help Me.
Help me, I think I'm falling in love again. When I get that crazy feeling, I know I'm in trouble again. I'm in trouble, cause you're a rambler and a gambler and a sweet talking ladies' man. And you love your loving.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you just joined us, we're talking about Joni Mitchell.
Down in the cellar in the bozo, I went looking for some sweet inspiration. Oh, well, just another hard time band with Negro affectations. I was a hopeful in rooms like this when I was working cheap. It's an old romance, the boho dance. It hasn't gone to sleep.
My guest is Syracuse University professor and music critic David Yaffe. He's written a terrific book called Reckless Daughter, A Portrait of Joni Mitchell. This is one of my favorite Joni Mitchell tunes called Boho Dance. If you'd like to join our conversation, we're at 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayWIPR. Let's go to the phones again. Lisa in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with David Yaffe.
Hi there. Yeah, I just hope you get to talk about Hejira, which is one of my favorites. I feel like she just took such an artistic leap with that one, just the driving rhythms in it. So I appreciate your comments. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Lisa.
One of my favorites as well, of course.
And what do you think sets that one apart? I mean, she was never one to repeat herself, was she?
No.
I mean, each album seemed to be a totally new incarnation of herself.
Well, it was the first album that had Jaco Pastorius on it. And he was the bass player of her dreams. She was very impatient with bass players that she just thought were going plotty, plotty, plotty. You know, she wanted to open up the bottom end, you know, and she wanted to be stimulated by the bottom end. And Jaco did exactly what she wanted bass players to do. The bass player on Court and Spark and Hissing of Summer Lawns was Max Bennett, and also a guy named Wilton Felder. And these guys were very, very good. Max Bennett was a very accomplished studio musician who played with, you know, Dizzy Gillespie. He played on Fever. He chose Fever. You know, he was a very accomplished bass player. But Jaco was something else altogether. He was a wild animal and a genius. And he was like the Charlie Parker of the fretless bass, you know. He was a revolutionary. And she loved that. And so he's on four tracks. He's on Coyote and Black Crow and Refuge of the Roads. And what you hear is a dialogue going on in those songs. And so there's that. And also, she was just in a really inspired moment. You know, she ran out on her tour. She skipped several months of a tour, lost a lot of money doing that, as did the musicians on that tour. And she went on this road trip, going back and forth from the East Coast back to the West, and wrote most of those songs on that tour, on that road trip. She'd written a few of them already, but she wrote a couple of them on Rolling Thunder with Bob Dylan, but the rest she did on this crazy road trip. And so it was just this moment of introspection, and this feeling of being really where she needs to be, not to be happy, but to be writing. And that is to be between relationships and having both the freedom of independence, which was something that she always cherished, but also the longing for love and being in a committed relationship. And because she was frustrated, you know, she had these messages out to the recent ex-lover in that situation, the drummer John Guerin, who actually plays on Hey Jira. And but also it made her a philosopher, you know. And so you have the musical innovation, you have the depth of the lyrics, and they're such personal lyrics. And there's some of my very favorite Joni Mitchell songs on that album, Song for Sharon. What an incredible song that is. Mm-hmm. Every song on that album is incredible. Amelia, that's just what a great, great song.
Yeah, about Amelia going Earhart. It's a phenomenal song. Of course, the word Hijera, you write, means escape with honor. Mm-hmm. And the Boho Dance, the song that we started this segment with, you call it part of a series of I Hate Show Business songs.
Mm-hmm.
What was her relationship with the business?
Interesting, because if you're a musician now making pop music, and especially trying to make serious pop music and not just, you know, pablum, you would look at the 70s as a golden age. But Joni's in that golden age, and it didn't seem at all golden, you know? And this was somebody, she lived with David Geffen when she wrote the Court and Spark songs. No major artist has lived with a label boss like that. She not only lived with David Geffen, he inspired one of her songs on that album, Free Man in Paris. Nobody had done this. So on the one hand, she's in with the man. But on the other hand, I guess it gives her perspective from all the sides to then indict it, because she sees how corrupt it all is. And especially as her own commercial fortune started to slip, she became increasingly bitter about it. Boho Dance was commentary, you know. She read this article by Tom Wolfe that was in Harper's that was later turned into a book called The Painted Word. And he talked about the Boho Dance being the time when the artist is struggling. And there's this myth of being in this, you know, bohemian squalor. And that's sort of fetishized before the artist then makes it. And that was, of course, exactly what the track that Joni was on. She was poor. But when she was poor, she aspired to not be poor. And that's what, you know, even in the scuffle, the cleaner's press was in my jeans. Right?
Yeah. And you know, the streets were never really mine.
Right?
Not mine,
right.
These glamour gowns. So it
that's
was,
right.
It was, she was torn between these two spheres, the folky, funky people and, you know, the woman in the Paris dress with runs in her nylons.
Yeah.
It's all from the Boho Dance.
It's just incredible
You have a great anecdote about David Geffen, speaking of him, which I just just loved, that he went to work for the William Morris Agency in the mailroom, like everybody did. But he got there under kind of false pretenses. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, he faked a degree from USC. In fact, he dropped out of Brooklyn College. And so he knew that a letter would come from USC saying that he'd faked his degree. And so when that letter came in, he was working in the mailroom, conveniently enough. So when the letter came in, he had it steamed opened, and then he somehow got into the registrar's office, got stationery, and wrote a fake letter. And now...
he's David Geffen.
Now, not only that, but there's a music industry program at USC named for him. He endowed a program there.
Yeah. That's just, I mean, it's an incredible insight. And he was very, a formidable figure in Joni Mitchell's rise. I mean, he helped her a lot. Yeah. And the rise of many other people, too. I mean,
You know, he starts this label, Asylum, and, you know, she records for it, starting with For the Roses. And before that, he was the label boss. He was the one that told her not to go to Woodstock, because she might miss Dick Cavett. And that was an incredible move. She was sad to miss it. But then the sadness inspired the song. And if she'd gone, she wouldn't have written the song.
Yeah, she ended up writing the anthem that has meant Woodstock for everybody else since. Yeah, incredible.
And for those of us who grew up on classic rock radio, that was the Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young version of that song is a staple of classic rock radio.
Absolutely. Here's another tune from an album she did in 1991 called Night Ride Home. This is called Cherokee Louise. Thank you. This song just breaks my heart. It's such a beautiful song. It tells the story of a young, troubled girl who's been abused, and it's—I swear to God—I cannot listen to this song without tears streaming down my face. She and Joni Mitchell takes from her inspiration everything from the Bible to you know, real situations. The Broadway Bridge is a real place. You've talked about a couple of other songs where you know, things are real people, real places, real mothers, real fathers. She drew from an incredible pool of places for inspiration.
Yeah, and that song, which has a great soprano part by Wayne Shorter, by the way, which in a way is another way of telling the story that she's telling. He did something similar to what Jaco Pastorius did, being in sync with her. But also, yes, that song was about a girl that she knew from school in Saskatoon who was misunderstood. And she said at the Broadway Bridge, Saskatoon liked to call itself the City of Bridges, the Paris of the North.
Yeah. Saskatoon, Canada, right? The Paris of the North, yeah, right,
yeah.
And just, we only got about a minute left. The fact that she had polio sort of debilitated her left hand, and it forced her to figure out a new way of playing the guitar, and that led to this amazing harmonic language that she came up with. That's an incredible story in itself.
It is, because she did not intend to come up with something that sounded different from other guitar players. It came out of necessity. And yet, at a certain point, she realized that, in fact, her guitar playing didn't sound like other people's, because alternate tunings create different resonances.
Yeah, well, this is really a fascinating read, and I appreciate your time and appreciate the book. Oh, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
David Yaffe is the author of Reckless Daughter, A Portrait of Joni Mitchell. It's published last fall by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. He's on the faculty of Syracuse University, and he's joined us from Syracuse at the studios of WAER Radio, so our thanks to the folks at WAER. David has written a couple of other books, one on jazz and another on Bob Dylan. He also writes music criticism for The New York Times, The Nation, and others. We've got a link to his work on our website, wipr.org/midday. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, a preview of the Motor Trend International Auto Show, which starts tomorrow at the Baltimore Convention Center. We'll walk the floor with Rory Cahill. He's 13 years old, and his opinions about cars are sought after by the likes of General Motors. We'll also talk about industry trends with award-winning New York Times contributor Tom Volk, plus theater critic J. Wynn Russick. She's going to review Long Day's Journey Into Night. That's at Baltimore's Everyman Theater. Lunch today was provided by Dangerously Delicious Pies, with locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the square in Canton and at 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. Their menu includes a large variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches. More information on the web at dangerouspiesbalt.com. We'll leave you with a little bit more Joni Mitchell. This is Shine. Life in the Balance is up next. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Have a great day.
Shine on good earth, good air, good water, and a safe place for kids to play. Shine on bombs exploding half a mile away.